When you fly to Africa and you go down to the Mediterranean, you then hit the North African coast, and you fly over the North African coast all the way down to wherever you happen to go, say Kenya or South Africa or Nigeria or wherever you happen to be going. And for 4 hours from hitting that North African coast, you're over desert. For four whole hours, at 500 miles an hour, there's nothing but rock and sand and scrub. There's virtually no scrubber at all. It's just simply desert underneath you. If you were to go the other way, I think it's about 3,500, that's about 2,000 miles deep, the Sahara. I think it's about, 3,500 to 4,000 miles? I've never flown it that way. But I know that if you were to travel, say, down to Kenya, the chances are you'd fly over Libya. As you travel down from the UK, you'd come across over Libya, slightly western Libya. And as you went down to, say, Kenya, the chances are you would fly very close to a place called Leptis Magna. Now, Leptis Magna is a tourist attraction in Libya. I went down there to visit my brother when I was a teenager, in my late teens, and we called in on Leptis Magna. We saw Leptis Magna. It's a huge Roman ruin. There is a lighthouse there, an old Roman lighthouse. There are baths, there are amphitheatres, there are houses, all in the states of decay. And because it's desert, the sand's been covering it over, and they've therefore been able to excavate it and take the sand off. And it has been preserved quite remarkably. It's quite a remarkable ruin. But you think, what on earth is a ruin like that, of that size of town, doing in desert? Well, the answer is that it wasn't always desert. Leptis Magna was the port that the galleys used to come into and load up with grain to take back to Rome and to the rest of the empire, which was in the north of the Mediterranean. And they used that particular port city of Leptis Magna to do that. And they had, they had a harbour that they could bring the galleys in, and they could load. You can see all the harbour walls and everything else. It's all there today. That's why they had the lighthouse there to guide the galleys in, the slaves and everything else. And they'd load them up with grain and take them across to Rome. Now that is a physical reminder. And yet you fly over it today, for 4 hours solid, you're over a complete and total desert. Babylon has destroyed this earth. It really has. You go around this earth, and America is going to go the same way. I mean, it will. It'll wreck the soil, and eventually you'll end up with nothing but desert there. You fly over Spain today. The climate is changing. You fly over Spain and all that area, and you look down, and it's brown and it's desolate. It's the southern part of France also is starting to become part of the desert that is there. But you know, when the kingdom of God comes, when the millennium actually arrives here, God's way is to take the desert and have it bloom again. It's to take land and have reclaimed. Now, some of it is going, a great deal of it will be by divine intervention that will churn up this earth, which will flatten the mountains. There are certain things like the Gobi Desert and so on that have mountain ranges that stop the rain from going in. And various mountain ranges will be removed. But once it has been removed, you're looking at something that is going to make that and preserve that fertility that is in the land. And build that facility up and make the fertility that much more fertile. It talks about in Amos 9 about the plowman overtaking the reaper. So fertile will the land be. Now, something obviously is going to happen. Something will be there which will cause these things to happen. Something will be there to cause the world tomorrow to be the kind of place it is. Yes, Satan will be removed, but in its place will be the Spirit of God. And in its place, Satan's way will be removed, but in its place will be the way and the laws of God. What I want to do today is I want to examine three laws, just three laws of God, which apart from the Ten Commandments, if you put the Ten Commandments to one side and you say, well, what three laws are going to be probably the greatest three laws that will reshape this earth during the millennium? I would say that these three probably come pretty close. I can't think of another three that physically are probably going to reshape this earth more than any other laws of God. When you're looking out over the landscape and everything else. And on the face of it, it doesn't look that way. You wouldn't look at them and think this at all. You'd look at them and think, oh, they're just some ancient laws that applied at that time, but have nothing, no bearing on the future at all. But those three are the sabbatical year, the jubilee, and the laws of usury in regard to money. Those three laws, as far as interest is concerned and how interest will actually be used. And I think that by the time the sermon is finished, you'll see there's a great deal more behind those three laws that meet the eye just at first glance. Now, I've given certain sermons similar to this in the past at the feast, but I think it's necessary to go through it again and to really understand just how God makes a very simple law that on the surface, anybody would look at it and think, oh, ridiculous. It's almost very, very similar. I mean, you look at this world. I mean, the world itself. What are we looking at? Protons, neutrons, and electrons. Simplicity itself. 100 elements. And the whole thing comes out of that. It's a simple, very, very simple basic laws. But the diversity that comes out of it. It's exactly the same when you look into the law of God and you see very simple, basic laws, but the diversity that comes out of it when you start to examine what in fact is in there and what the implications of these laws are, that's when it becomes really interesting. And I think in looking forward into the future, looking forward into the millennium, we need to be aware that this mind of God is what's going to be producing the millennium. And it is the law, the way his law works, the way his ways work, that we need to start to understand and get our own mind thinking along those directions instead of the way the world is right now outside. Turn over to 2 Chronicles 36. 2 Chronicles 36. Right at the end of 2 Chronicles. When Israel and then finally Judah went into captivity. And here in 2 Chronicles 36, a certain statement is made. In 2 Chronicles 36, in verse 19, it says, "And they burnt the house of God, they broke down the wall of Jerusalem." Here are the Babylonians coming in and doing this. "They burnt all the palaces thereof with fire, destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And then them that had escaped the sword carried he away to Babylon, where they were the slaves of him and the son until the reign of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Eternal by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths." And he says, as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbaths to fulfill 70 years. So here is a desolate land fulfilling the Sabbath, the sabbatical years. And looking at that, you'll think, well, that's all there is to the sabbatical year. Just the fact that the land just goes back to complete, total desolation. And you couldn't be further from the truth. There's a great deal more. It's like somebody saying to you, right, somebody who's lived a life for 70, 80 years, and he says, right, you're going to die. And while you're dead, in your grave, you will be keeping the Sabbath. True, you will be resting. But is that really keeping the Sabbath? Is that really what the Sabbath is designed for? And yet this law of the sabbatical year is part of the Sabbath command. And it's a very, very similar way that here it's saying, look, here is the land completely desolate. But you know, it's keeping its Sabbath. And yes, it is. It's resting. But just in the same way as if you're dead and in your grave, you're resting. You're asleep. But being asleep, you know, you don't come to Friday night and tuck yourself in bed and curl up in a ball. Maybe you do, depending how the week's been. But, you know, you don't touch yourself up in bed and sleep right the way through until Saturday night as well. You don't come to Friday night and sleep right the way through to Saturday night. The Sabbath has got more to it than that. It's supposed to be a delight. It's supposed to leave other people refreshed. These are all parts of the Sabbath command. And when you're looking at living by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, you've got to put all these other bits into there as well to really keep the Sabbath properly. It's got to be a convocation. So if you can, you need to meet with people, if that is possible. That's what it says. And therefore, we put that into effect. It's a holy day. And we're supposed to be thinking God's thoughts, not our own thoughts. All these things come into mind. So if you're comatose and you're dead, you're lying in your grave, you're not keeping the Sabbath in that way, any more than a land that is totally desolate is keeping a sabbatical year, because there's more to the sabbatical year than that. And if we look at the spirit of the law, or the letter of the law, let's turn over to where it's actually mentioned over in Leviticus 25. In Leviticus 25, we find the sabbatical law mentioned here in regard to agriculture. And it says in Leviticus 25, verse 1, it says, "And the Eternal spoke to Moses in Mount Sinai, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them that when you come into the land which I give you," and let's face it, when you come into the millennium which I give you, it's the same kind of thing, it's the same God, it's the same thinking, he doesn't change. "When I come into the land that I give you, then you shall keep a Sabbath to the Eternal." It says the land will keep a Sabbath to the Eternal. "6 years shall you sow your field, and 6 years you will prune your vineyard and gather the fruit thereof. But in the 7th year shall be a Sabbath of rest to the land, a Sabbath of the Eternal, where you will neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. That which grows of its own accord of your harvest you shall not reap, neither shall you gather the grapes of your vine undressed, for it's a year of rest to the land." And it, on the surface, it looks like you just leave it. And it just basically sits there, and it just goes back to rack and ruin, and that's all there is to it. But notice what it says, verse 6. "And the Sabbath of the land shall be food for you, for you and your servant, and for your maid and your hired servant, your stranger that sojourns with you." But hang on a minute, he just said don't reap. So it obviously doesn't mean that you can't go ahead and gather the food yourself. It means you don't reap for commercial purposes. And suddenly the books and the pages of the book start to open, and we start to see a little bit more about this particular command. "And for your cattle and for the beasts that are in your land shall be for increase thereof for food." So now you've got to have animals to eat the food that comes off it and to keep the land in a certain state. It reflects on the very agriculture that is going to be present for a nation. And remember, these laws, the laws of the sabbatical year, the jubilee, and the usury laws, have basically never been kept. They've never been kept. So that for the first time in all of human history, we're looking at a time when these laws will be put into place. I mean, otherwise, why are they here? Because Israel didn't keep them. Supposed to. It was part of the law, but it's part of the principles of God, but they never kept them. I remember talking to somebody, there was a minister who was in charge of the farm down in Ghana. There's two people you probably think it can be, I'm not going to tell you which one it was. But this particular minister, he'd never taken agricultural class in college, he'd never had anything to do with farming or agriculture or whatever, but he was basically looking after the farm. And he mentioned to me, he said, "Well, you know, we're keeping a sabbatical year." I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "What do you mean, what am I doing?" I said, how are you keeping the sabbatical year? This is very interesting. What are you doing to in order to keep it?" He says, "Well, we don't do anything. We just leave it." I said, "That's not the way you keep the sabbatical year." And he had no concept whatsoever of the things that were taught in college regarding the sabbatical year and the things that the research that was done regarding the sabbatical year. You see, yes, there is a gradual return to fertility. If you just simply leave your land and do nothing with it, then the land will indeed go back to a fertile position. But it could take several hundred years. If you go over to the Rothamsted, down in where we used to live, down in Harpenden, that is just north of London, there's a place there called Rothamsted, which is literally, we used to come out of the end of our drive, and it was just on the other side from where we used to live with Rothamsted. It's probably, in fact, I think it is, the oldest agricultural research station in the world. And in there, there's a place called the Broadbalk Wilderness. And it is a wilderness today. And what they did back in the 18, whatever it was, the early 1800s, when they first started Rothamsted, they divided land up into plots. Of land, you know, it might be maybe half an acre, maybe an acre, each plot of land. And each plot of land they treated in a different way. One of them they just took all, they sowed it with grain and they took the grain off. They sowed it with grain, they took the grain off. And they did that year after year after year and never gave it any rest at all. Another one they might rest it, another one they might put manure on it, another one they might rotate, another one they just completely left, never did anything with. And you can go back to Rothamsted and on this broadback experiment now, and in the place where they are just still planting grain and harvesting, I mean, the grain's stunted and it just, you know, it really is pathetic what is actually there, what is actually being coming off that little plot. In the one where they've left it and nothing else, you know, just been left since the 1800s, there are huge trees. You know, huge trees. It's just gone back to woodland. It's just total, complete, and utter woodland. Other areas they've actually grazed, and it's grassland. And you can see the difference between the different treatment of the land, and how the land is treated has a great deal to do with what is actually going on underneath, what's going on in the fertility of that soil. And we're looking at the millennium, we're looking at a time when the fertility is going to increase. When you're not going to have the Sahara produced the way the Sahara has been produced, because that was a fertile area at one time. Now, what happened as far as the agricultural department is concerned? They analysed this scripture and other scriptures, and they said, right, this is a binding law by God. And indeed it is. It's a binding law as far as God is concerned. And if you are farming and you are able to go ahead and implement this sabbatical year, so you should. However, and there's a big however, there is more to it than just looking at this. Because when you look at the spirit of the law and you start to understand what is within the sabbatical law, you start to understand how it tells us how the land itself has got to be farmed. There's a great deal of information, which I'll come into, that'll tell us how the land is going to be farmed in the future. And let's just take another way of looking at the spirit of the law. Let's take the Sabbath day itself. Imagine that you are in a plane, say. You're traveling across the Pacific somewhere, and the plane goes down. You know, what was that one, Castaway, wasn't it? That's right, where he had this coconut and he put his, whatever it was on it, this face on it. But the plane came down, and you survived. However, it came down in such a way that you're knocked out unconscious, and you don't know how long you're quite unconscious, and you find yourself on a desert island, like Tom, whatever his name is, and Hanks, and you're cast away. Are you going to keep the Sabbath? I would hope so. I would hope you'd keep the Sabbath. Okay. How do you know which day you're going to keep it on? What day you're going to choose? Can you determine what day the Sabbath is if you might have been unconscious for several days? And you don't know how long you've been unconscious? You see, the principle of the Sabbath would still apply. And you would keep the Sabbath regardless. You'd try and determine to the best of your ability what day was the Sabbath, and you would keep it. And you'd keep it the way God intended. You then come out of the desert island, perhaps be rescued, and you suddenly find, oh, hang on, I'm 3 days off, or whatever it might be, and you'd then change and you'd go back to what you ought to be keeping it. And that is the way God's law works. The principle has got to be applied regardless. You've got to have a mind that goes and flows along the way God's mind works. And the problem with the sabbatical year is we don't know when it is. You see, it's a specific year. Because it's tied in with the Jubilee, and we don't know when the Jubilee is either. We won't know until Christ returns as to when that specific year is. We don't know when the sabbatical year is, and we don't know which particular year to go ahead and keep it on. There are also other aspects of the sabbatical year that it is impossible to keep today in the current society. And we'll go and have a look at that in a minute. But what happened in the past, back in the 50s, is the church misapplied the letter of the law. And it did. It misapplied it. And many farmers went bankrupt as a result of misapplying it. Why? Because these were grain farmers. Not only were they grain farmers, but they were grain farmers with huge mortgages and huge overdrafts that had gone to the bank and got money for all their equipment and everything else. And they said, I've got to keep God's law, I'm not going to go ahead and sow anything, so they just left the land, and the land went completely derelict. so that when they went and tried to plow the following year, the thing was full of weeds, and the grain therefore didn't do very well the following year either, and they went bankrupt. And a number of farmers went bankrupt in that way in the 50s because of misapplication of this law. And Mr. Armstrong saw that, and Mr. Armstrong also saw something else, and you'll find there's something else over in Deuteronomy 14. In Deuteronomy chapter 14, look at the very end of it. You see, the sabbatical year is tied to another law as well. In verse 28 of Deuteronomy 14, it says, "At the end of 3 years, you will bring forth all the tithe of your increase in the same year, and you'll lay it up within your gates. And the Levite, because he has no part of inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow which are within your gates shall come and eat and be satisfied, that the Eternal your God may bless you in the work of your hand which you do." Now there's the third tithe year. And we apply that. But it's not just every third year. It's every third and sixth year in a 7-year cycle. And you say, well, why is that? Because in the next verse, at the end of every 7 years, you will make a release. So you go three. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then you have a release. And then you start again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then you have a release. And it's because of these verses and the way chapter 14 runs into chapter 15, the way the third tithe works. Now again, we don't know when that year ought to be. So it's determined by baptism, by when we find out about it. Really, it's left in our hands as to how this applies. Same with the sabbatical year as well. But Mr. Armstrong looked at these verses that then carry on in chapter 15, and this is the manner of the release. Here is the sabbatical year. Now, this is another part of the law. Every creditor that lends anything to his neighbour shall release it. He shall not exact of his neighbour or his brother, because it's the Eternal's release. Now, here was this farmer into hock to the bank. And he just come up, you can imagine him going down to the bank and saying, "I know I owe you this mortgage for the farm, and I know I owe you this money also for all these, you know, £120,000 tractors I've just bought, and the combine harvester, which was a quarter of a million. But, you, hey, it's a sabbatical year, you've got to go have and release me." Oh, yeah. As if, if only. You see, we can't apply this. It doesn't work that way in today's society. Now, the agriculture department was absolutely adamant and saying, no, this must be applied and all the rest of it, and saw all the ramifications of the sabbatical year. But Mr. Armstrong, in his wisdom, said, hang on a minute. There are applications of this sabbatical year which we cannot apply today. So we've got to apply the principle, and therefore he said it is permissible for farmers today to go ahead and rest a seventh of the land. If it's going to have an effect on your, you know, if you're having to pay your mortgage, if you're having to pay for the equipment that you've got, then you rest a seventh. It makes sense within today's society. The principle still applies, but you apply it in that way. And that was the decision. And as I say, people disagreed with that decision from Mr. Armstrong. Now, does that mean to say that we'll apply it that way in the future, in the millennium? The answer is no. Because when we come to the millennium, Christ will have returned, we'll know when the Jubilee is, we'll know when the sabbatical year is, we'll know when the third tithe years ought to run, and we'll be able to apply it properly. And in addition, we won't have any banks. The banks will have gone. And we'll come on to that and see that in a little while. But here, as it says in verse 3, notice, it says, "Of a foreigner you may exact it again, but that which is with your brother you shall release." Now, we'll come on to that again as well, that there is a difference between foreigners and also those that are in the land, those that are counted as brethren, those that are counted as part of Israel. There is a difference and a distinct difference. It says, "To the end that," in verse 4, "there shall be no poor amongst you." That's what God is looking for. That is what he's aiming for. This is the purpose of it. "For the Eternal will greatly bless you in the land that the Eternal your God gives you for an inheritance to possess it." And it says in verse 7, "If there be among you a poor man or one of your brethren within any of your gates in the land which the Eternal your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand from your poor brother." Just notice how consistent this law is with the instructions from Christ. I mean, in Christ's instructions were along these lines. You know, if somebody would lend something from you, you'll go ahead and lend them. But you will open your hand wide to him, and you will surely lend him sufficient for his need in that which he wants. Beware that there's not a thought in your wicked heart saying the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and your eye is evil against your poor brother, and you don't give him anything, and he cries to the Eternal against you, and it be sin to you. You shall surely give him, and your heart shall not be grieved when you give to him, because of the thing that the Eternal your God shall bless you in all your works and in all that you put your hand to. For the poor shall never cease out of the land, poor shall never cease out of the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother, to the poor and the needy in your land. Now that is in the context of the sabbatical year being this year of release. And it is a case that we have got to therefore look at the way in which the sabbatical year is applied in the spirit of the law. Now Mr. Armstrong used the spirit of the law to make his decision as to how the sabbatical year may be applied. It doesn't have to be applied this way. It can be according to your third tithe year as well, if you wish. You can go ahead and apply it that way, and that's a better way of doing it. But for a commercial farmer, he made this judgmental decision that, no, you cannot apply this year of release, which is tied to it. It just simply is not possible within today's society. Therefore, he applies the principle into applying the seventh year. We turn over to Psalm 119. Sorry, a seventh of your land, I meant. If you turn over to Psalm 119, you find in Psalm 119, notice in verse 25, it says, my soul cleaves to dust. Make me alive according to your word. I've declared my ways, and you have heard me. Teach me your statutes. Make me to understand the way of your precepts, so I will talk of your wondrous works. It says, my soul melts for heaviness. Strengthen me according to your word. Remove from me the way of lying. It's not just lying, it's the way of lying. This is the spirit of the law. You go and you try and find out, you know, what is it behind the lie? And, you know, you go over to Ephesians and you find that we don't lie because we're members one of another. And it says here, remove from me the way of lying. Grant me your law graciously. Allow me to go ahead and have my words with grace. In other words, applying the spirit of the law. I've chosen the way of truth. It's a different way. It's a different direction. That is what is important. Your judgments have I laid before me. I have stuck to your testimonies, O Eternal. Don't put me to shame, because I'm going to run in the way of your commandments. Not just walk, I'll run. I'll do everything within my power to go within that way, to go and point myself in that direction. When you shall enlarge my heart, when the Spirit of God is there. It's a spiritual direction. It's a spiritual way that is so important. And if we look at this subject of the land Sabbath, of the sabbatical year, and you look at the spiritual implications, you look at the spiritual breadth of it, you look at the magnification of the law, then we, we've just been reading over in Deuteronomy 15, it's a year of release. Now, can you imagine that here is a country, or whichever country you happen to be in, and it has this year of release? So every seventh year, any debt is cancelled. Any monetary debt is cancelled. Now, it doesn't apply to where somebody's sold some land. You don't give the land back in that. That's the Jubilee. We'll come on to that. But every monetary debt, where somebody has a monetary debt, it is forgiven, cancelled, removed, gone. Mortgages, don't have a mortgage, disappears. You know, loans from the bank, business loans, college loans, whatever it might be, has gone every 7 years. The whole society starts a clean monetary site. How about you imagining that and being a banker? Could you be a banker in such an environment? Is it possible? The answer is no. The banks as we see them today are based on usury. They're based on getting interest and they're binding people in. You go over to India, people put themselves under moneylenders in India, and the debt is passed on from generation to generation to generation. People have been in there maybe four or five generations of debt, and they become slaves because of that debt. That's how bad it is over there. Now, we don't have that to the same degree over here. But people are slaves to the bank. No question of that. You see, banking, the implication of the sabbatical year, when you really start to understand it, is that banks, as we have it today, will not exist. There will be no banks as we have them today. There will be partnerships. There may be a collective partnership of some description whereby you go and you borrow money and people risk that money with you, much as the Arab banks do. The Arab banks actually do this, that you borrow money from an Arab bank and they become partners with you. It's more like the stock exchange in a project, in a venture. And you can either all lose it or all gain it. And you're all taking equal risk. Something like that is going to probably exist. But banks as we have them today, where you borrow money, you pay interest, and your interest and your capital remains owing to the bank for however many years, 20, 30, 40, whenever necessary. And the bank can go in there and just grab whatever it wants, whenever it wants it, if it just feels a little bit skittish about it, which is the way it works today. Will not exist. So you see, again, just that one area. Turn over to Exodus 23. Exodus 23, that one area of the year of release is a huge area. It's going to have incredible implications to the entire society. But here in Exodus 23, it says in verse 11, it says, "But the seventh year you shall," it's talking about land now, "the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie still, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave will the beast of the field eat, and like manner you'll eat with the vineyard and the olive yard." I want you to notice that first bit. Part of the land Sabbath is that you don't plough, that you don't rotivate. Now, if that is the case on the Sabbath, on the sabbatical year, how are you going to stop the weeds from coming into your garden then on year eight? You just leave it. I mean, you see our garden today. I mean, really, we've left it this year. And the weeds are up here. They're just ridiculous in size. I just have not spent the time necessary. I could have rested it properly, the way the land Sabbath is designed to be rested for a garden. How do you stop that? It's mulching. If you notice the Rothamsted experiment, this Broadbalk wilderness over in Rothamsted, you'll find that you've got grassland which has been eaten down by the animals, or you have this, the trees there and the leaf litter on the bottom. And you look at God's system, and it is a system of mulching. You look at the way in which the grassland works; it's mulching. The grass stays on the top; it binds the surface together. It stops the erosion from taking place, and one thing that you see for a lack of weeds where you're actually sowing crops, where you're trying to get a crop out of something, where you've got a garden, then you're going to have to mulch in some way to keep those weeds in check. And you're starting to look now at a different kind of agriculture. So what's going to be doing the digging that year? Well, they're called worms. They do the digging. So from a very simple law, you start to see something which is, no, there's much, much more to it than this. You're starting to see a kind of agriculture, an agriculture where you put litter manure, straw, hay, whatever else on the surface of the ground. The worms come up and they pull it in, and they start to actually turn the ground over, and you start to have, there's your fertility. I mean, you take a worm casting, and you try and analyze a worm casting compared to the surrounding soil, and the pHK, I mean, there's no question, phosphorus, potassium and nitrogen is way, way higher in a worm casting compared to the surrounding land. They actually improve the land in enormous amount And it's not just that they're eating the actual organic matter, although that they are. There seems to be something that they actually grind the minerals up, and they release these nutrients to the plant. So you more you worms you have in there, the more fertile your soil is going to be. And you have this as a cumulative effect, and you're suddenly starting to see these grapes on poles and this kind of thing. And it's coming from what? A law that says rest your land every 7 years. Is more than that. There's so much more to it. As I say, soil erosion. You look at these floods that occur abroad. What's happening? The water comes down, they washes the whole thing away. What in fact would happen if you're not mulching the area for the garden, and you'd only be able to mulch a relatively small area, what happens to the rest of it? Well, remember what we read. It said that you don't. Not only is it a case that you go ahead and rest your land, but it will be food for you, and it will also be food for your animals, so that you immediately now have grassland, and the grassland is eaten down. And again, we'll come on to that in a little while. But the fertility, because of the worms, the mulching, the soil erosion, the water pollution, again, is locking the nutrients within that soil. You're not going to have these kind of water pollution. Much of the pollution that we've got in the world today is caused by nitrogen fertilizers. It really is. Nitrogen fertilizers washing off the land, washing this out of the land, and there's nothing there to bind it. And yet you're looking at a very very different system. Let's turn over here in Exodus 23. Just notice what it says. It says in verse 9, it says, "Also you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, seeing that you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And for 6 years you shall sow your land, and you will gather the fruits thereof. But the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie still, and the poor of your people may eat. And what they leave, the beasts of the field will eat. And in like manner shall you deal with your vineyard and with your olive yard." So we're here seeing that this land, this law, is also talking about the poor and the strangers. It's something that is giving, it is outgoing. It's not just something that you do for yourself and for your family. It goes to the strangers, to the people outside. It's an outgoing law. If you turn back to Leviticus 25... In Leviticus 25, we find the same thing mentioned, notice, over in verse... the end result of these laws, as it says in verse 23, if we notice what the end result is, it says, "The land shall not be sold forever." Now, this is talking about the Jubilee. It says, "For the land is mine, and you are the strangers and sojourners with me." The attitude toward the land is different. And as we'll go into the Jubilee and start to understand a little bit about that, if we get the time, we'll find that very much this is the concept, that the land is God's. And we are people who manage that, who have a responsibility before God to manage that land. Now, in verse 8, notice, of this Leviticus 25, it says, "And you shall number 7 Sabbaths of years." I want you to notice how the sabbatical year is actually tied into the Jubilee. 7 Sabbaths of years to you, 7 times 7 years, and the space of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be unto you 49 years. So the Jubilee is starting to be mentioned within the context of the sabbatical year. The two are tied up together. And when we come into the Jubilee and start understanding a bit more about the Jubilee, we find that it is pointing us into the direction that the land is managed by the families. That the land is not sold forever. It is the family's responsibilities to look after the land. Each family has an area of land. Each family has the responsibility to actually look after that land. Now, when you look at such things, and notice what it says over in verse 5. It says, "That which grows of its own accord of your harvest you shall not reap, neither gather the grapes of your vine undressed, for it's a year of rest to the land." Now, we see in the subsequent verse that you feed for you and your family. It's food for you and your family, but it's not to be sold. So what does that then tell us about the the society in which we live? Well, it knocks on the head all supermarkets. Supermarkets cannot exist in the future. It is impossible. Because 1 year, they would have no produce to buy at all. And another year, all those that had produce would be keeping it for themselves because it would be the sixth year, getting ready for the seventh. So the chances of them getting, I mean, they'd be sky high. They would not be able to compete. And besides, people would have their own. And the eighth year, there would be, it would be afterwards. They would have to be mulching to keep it in that for their own garden. So a supermarket simply will not be able to function. Nor would greengrocers. A greengrocer will not function. Do you see how this one law is changing the way we look at life, the way that we look at society? We're looking at market gardeners. Can't exist. Unless you, flowers? Can you do flowers? I suppose you probably do flowers, but that's about the nearest you can do it. But not for food production, you couldn't do it. Market gardeners cannot exist. Not with this law. It just doesn't fit. They couldn't fit in this law because one year, they would have to leave the land idle. And there's more to it even than that. When you look at the subject, you're looking at also the fact that grain is going to have to be stored. It's going to have to be stored over a year. You're going to have over a year's supply. Because at the moment, you store it for a year. You've got a year's supply. You should have, because you store it for a year, and then you start filling your silo again. So you're going to have to store it for 2 years. And you suddenly see why Joseph is going to have a job. Because he knows about grain storage. You know, the storing of grain is it's not so easy. It can be. You get mold in grain. You do rye, you'd start storing rye and any kind of moldy condition or harvesting it, and you've got ergot in there, and the ergot is fungus, you'll kill a lot of people. You really ergot, ergometrin. You know ergometrin, where you have ergometrin when a woman is having a baby. And gets an injection. She gets an injection of ergometrin, which closes the womb up, and it also shrinks the blood vessels. And basically, if you get too much ergometrin, you die a lot. And this is basically what happens. An ergot is a little tiny black fungus thing that grows on the side of the grain, and it's produced in damp conditions. So you've got to store your grain. You've got to be careful about storing grain. It's not something that you do lightly. So, again, you're starting to see grain storage, fodder storage. You can't go ahead and harvest hay. You can't go and plow, you can't harvest hay. You turn your animals into the land, into land that you'd normally be going ahead and growing your crops on. Another thing, notice in verse 7, it says, "And it's for your cattle and for the beasts that are in your land and for all the increase there is going to be food." What does that verse tell you about society? And it is that you've got a mixed agriculture. You've got to have a mixed agriculture on each farm. You cannot have these 8,000 cow herds that they've got in California. Impossible to do that. You cannot have the thousands of acres of grain land. Impossible when it comes to the sabbatical year. You've got to have mixed agriculture on a smaller basis. It is just simply not possible to do it any other way. Notice verse 6. "The Sabbath of the land shall be food for you. For you, for your servant, for your maid, for your hired servant, stranger that sojourns with you." So the people immediately associated with you. But you can't sell it off. So what's that telling you? It's telling you that the predominant place that people will be living will be small holdings. You cannot have it any other way. It's got to be. The idea that we're going to have these mega cities are ridiculous. And we'll come on and have a look and see what in fact the cities are is indicated within that. Now it talks about a land of unwalled villages, and this concept of being self-sufficient as a family and you having to be self-sufficient as a family for that seventh year is going to lead to a land of unwalled villages. It's going to lead to a people that are tied to the land. It's got to be. Now, it could be by family. It doesn't have to be that you have got to work. You know, you might have a cobbler's or whatever, but somebody in the family is going to have to keep a garden and supply the family with the garden produce. Or within the community somewhere. It's got to be that way. And it's, you can't go and trade. It's not, no, you can't go do a trade on that year because it's forbidden. You're not allowed to go ahead and harvest like that. You can't be a greengrocer. Another thing that it will do as well is the diversification of varieties. You go to the EU today and you have how many apples? So many apple varieties. You're not allowed to grow more than these certain varieties of apple. Cucumbers have got to be a certain straightness. You're not allowed to bend more than a certain amount. At cabbages, they've got to be a certain type of cabbage. And on it goes. But what does this tell you? Well, strawberries. If you grow strawberries, how long does a strawberry crop last? 2 weeks? 3 weeks maybe? Something like that? Yes, but if you grow the varieties properly, you can crop one variety which will grow this time, and the next variety which will grow this time, and the next variety will grow that time, and these varieties will then keep you in strawberries for several months. And same with many things, the growing of French beans, or you start with your French beans and you end up with your runner beans and extend the season both ways, and you put, you know, flushes on the beginning of the season. And you, by growing different varieties, so you gain your extension of the season. Now, obviously, you're going to have to do that. The varieties are going to have to be there to give you that extension, because you can't go out and crop, harvest it and store it. You've got to go out, harvest it, take it straight to your plate and eat it. That's the difference. So you're going to have the varieties diverse. You're also looking for crops that are going to self-seed. Now, if you leave, we got beans that basically you leave the beans, they go black, and they finally self-seed, and they'll fall down, and you could maybe the year before you could kind of rake them over and hope the mice don't get them. Then some of them might survive. The potatoes, you can leave them in the ground and they will come up the following year, and you can go and dig your potatoes up and you've got them. Or if you do it the other way, where you've got mulch on top, you scratch your mulch away and you've got another crop of potatoes the following year. So you can get things which will self-seed. Again, the way in which the things are organized are being dictated by that particular law. The fact that you cannot sell, but the indication is that the poor can come into the land and harvest for themselves, means there is a community spirit as well. It's all coming from this one law. The community spirit comes from that law. Meat and eggs will increase on a sabbatical year because you have to cut back the number of animals. The eggs, you'd let your chickens run wild on the land that you'd normally keep them off the grain, on the grain land. They would run completely right through the year. And the grain that self-seeds, they eat. So you're going to have more eggs, you're going to have more milk, more meat at that time. More milk, the milk, there's no problem with that. You're looking at the size of farms being cut down from what we've got today. You're looking, therefore, at family farms. You're looking, therefore, at family farms that will need wood to use on the farm. Therefore, you're looking at shelter belts. Therefore, you're looking at coppices of trees. You're looking at something that is used by the family. You're not looking at, you know, monoculture. You're looking at a mixed family farm with a bit of tree, with some arable, some land for the animals. You're looking at this mixture. You're looking at mixed farms across the globe. A totally different form of agriculture in many respects to the Western form. Now, in the underprivileged, the depressed areas, and they look at these areas, this is the kind of agriculture to some degree, but they don't put it into effect with the understanding. The mulching isn't there. The feeding back into the land isn't there. Another thing is perennial fruit trees. You're looking at perennial fruit trees being very important. Perennials generally will be, because it comes back every year. And so here we see this one law, just one law, knocking on the head our industrialized society. The whole industrialized society will be knocked on the head by this one law. You cannot keep the society that we are living in today alive and keep the sabbatical year the way it's intended. You just cannot do it. It is impossible. Just even this year of release of debt, and you're looking at this small independent family small holdings. It's the only way you can actually implement it. Now, when you start looking at the Jubilee, let's first of all, turn over to Ezekiel 36. Ezekiel 36. And let's look in Ezekiel 36. Just let's notice what it says here. It says in verse 10, it says, "And I will multiply men upon you, all the house of Israel, even all of it, and the cities shall be inhabited, and the wastes shall be builded." So there are going to be cities. But the problem is, what does it mean? I mean, the word city in Hebrew means something. It means to watch. It means a place of watching. It comes from people watching on the walls because of war, basically. That's where it comes from. But it's a case it's a place of watchfulness. And these cities, these places where people gather together and they're open all hours, that kind of thing, are going to be inhabited, and the waste shall be builded. And if we go over to, say, verse 24, "And I will sanctify my great name, which was profaned among the nations, and you profaned among the nations, and know that I am the Eternal, says the Lord Eternal, when I shall be sanctified in you before their eyes. For I'll take you from among the nations, and gather you out of all the countries, and I'll bring you to your own land. And then I will sprinkle clean water upon you, and you'll be clean from all your filthiness. And from all your idols I'll cleanse you, and a new heart also I'll give you. A new spirit I'll put within you, and I'll take away the stony heart out of your flesh. I'll give you a heart of flesh, and I will put my spirit within you. And I will cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will keep my judgments and do them," including the sabbatical year, including the Jubilee, as we'll come on to. "And you will dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers, and you will be my people, and I will be your God." And notice in verse 33, it says, "Thus says the Lord Eternal, in the day that I shall have cleansed you from all your iniquities, I also will cause you to dwell in the cities, and the waste will be builded. The desolate land will be tilled, whereas it lay desolate in the sight of all that passed by. And they shall say, this land that was desolate has become like the Garden of Eden." So the land is actually going to be reflecting the very Garden of Eden itself. "And the waste and desolate and ruined cities are become fenced." Now the word fenced literally means cut off or chopped off. It means, like a fence goes around. It's cut off in a certain area. "And are inhabited. Then the nations that are left round about you shall know that I, the Eternal, build the ruined places, plant that which is desolate. I have spoken, and I will do it. Thus says the Lord Eternal, I will yet for be inquired of by the house of Israel to do it for them. I will increase them like men, like a flock, and as a holy flock, as the flock of Jerusalem in her solemn feasts." Notice what it says. "So shall the waste cities be filled with flocks of men, and they will know that I am the Eternal." Now, it may well be, it's not saying specifically in that verse, but it certainly seems to indicate that part of the reason for the cities being there is so that, as it says, as in Jerusalem, a flock of men come in, like a flock of men in for the feast days, and they then keep the feast within Jerusalem. So the cities also are going to be filled with the same flocks of men that come in and will keep the feast days within the various cities. You're looking at cities that are going to be gathering centres. You're looking at cities that have auditoriums, which will have national works, which will have parks, which will have centres for meeting, offices or whatever for administration. And we then come into Ezekiel 37, dry bones, chapter 38. Notice in verse 11, it says, "And you will say, I will go down to the land of unwalled villages." So the actual area at the end of the millennium is going to be described as a land of unwalled villages. It's not going to be a land of cities. The cities are going to be there. There are going to be centres. But they seem to be centres that people will come into more than... They will be living in there as well. But you put the sabbatical year into the equation, it's not going to be the kind of cities that we've got today. It just simply isn't the way it is. If we turn back to Isaiah chapter 5, Isaiah 5. Now I'm going into this first before going into the Jubilee, because it helps us to understand the kind of land is going to be there. But in Isaiah chapter 5, there's a scripture here in verse 8. It says, "Woe unto them that join house to house, that lay field to field, until there is no place that they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth." Now God is not going to allow a world to develop whereby there's no place where we can be placed alone in the midst of the earth. It's not going to be field banged up to field, house banged up to house, so that you basically have nothing between. There are going to be common areas that people will go between. And I want you to notice in verse 13, that it's because of this. It says, "Therefore my people are gone into captivity." Part of the reason is that you see all these terraced houses that we've got today, that we've got the way in which the society has been built today, where even Chatsworth, thousands of acres in one person's hands. That's not the way of God. It will not be able to. You cannot have a place like Chatsworth in the future. It's just not possible. You won't be able to have that. So turn back to Leviticus 25 again. Leviticus 25, and we'll just read a little bit about the Jubilee. Because here in Leviticus 25, it says in verse 8, "And you will number 7 Sabbaths of years to you, 7 times 7 years, and the space of the 7 Sabbaths of years are 49 years. And you will cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. In the Day of Atonement you'll make the trumpet sound throughout all your land." Now, remember, you're looking at the sabbatical year. You're not allowed to till and harvest then. That'll be the 49th. And then you'll have another one, which will be the 50th. And then you'll have also to save for the preceding one. So you've got actually 3 years of store has got to be there. Now, again, when we're looking at the last great day and the time of the last great day, you're looking at storage of food, which will be necessary. And you're looking at 3 years' storage of certain foods that you cannot go out and actually harvest straight off the tree. So, again, you're looking at the landscape having these storage areas. And they're going to be there, and it almost indicates that when the last great day comes, it'll be in this time, the year of release, where it'll be around that period, probably. And it'll probably be in the autumn of the year, but we'll come into that tomorrow. But here in verse 10 it says, "And you'll hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all inhabitants thereof. It'll be a jubilee to you, and you shall return every man to his possession and every man to his family." Now the land, it's on the sabbatical year, the year of release, it's release of debt. On the Jubilee year, every 50 years, all the people that have had, say, sold the land off, they've gone ahead and have gone somewhere else to live or whatever, they've then returned to that land. The land and the family is then reunited once more. It stops a great deal of the, again, it stops these huge conglomerate farms. You cannot have a conglomerate farm like this. It just simply isn't possible. And it says, it's a jubilee, it'll be holy to you. And if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy anything of your neighbor's hand, you will not oppress one another. According to the number of years after the jubilee you will buy of your neighbor, according to the number of years of the fruits will he sell to you. So you can't actually buy the land. You buy the produce, you rent the land effectively for up to a maximum of 50 years. You cannot actually buy that land. You can buy within, as he goes in to explain, you can buy within the walled city, but actual land, the productive agricultural land, is not possible to actually buy. It says in verse, let's see, where can we pick this up? In verse 23, notice, "The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, and you are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the land of your possessions, you will grant a redemption for the land. So tied up to the Jubilee, you find that if a brother becomes poor, has sold away some of his possession, if any of his kin come to redeem it, then he shall redeem that which his brother sold. And this doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be at the Jubilee. It says, and if the man has nothing to redeem it, then he himself and himself be able to redeem it, then let him count the years of the sale thereof and restore the overplus. So if you, at the beginning, just after the Jubilee, you sell some land for, say, £10,000. And 25 years later, you decide, now I'm going to redeem it. And you've paid £10,000 for that land. You can pay £5,000 and get it back again, because it's the overplus. And it is geared to that. And you have the full right to go ahead and get that land of yours back for that £5,000. And there's more to it than that. It goes in, it says, if a man have nothing to redeem himself, it says, then let him count the years of the sale, restore the overplus. If he's not able to restore it to him, then that which is sold will remain in the hand of him that bought it until the year of the Jubilee. And in the Jubilee, it'll go out and return to his possession. And if a man sell a dwelling house in a walled city, this clipped city, then he may redeem it within a whole year after it's sold. A full year he can redeem it. If it's not redeemed within the space of a full year, that house in the walled city shall be established forever to him that bought it throughout his generations, and it will not go out in the Jubilee. So these cities are different. The cities you can actually go ahead and you can develop into whatever is necessary. And there you have your centres, there you have your communication centres. You can have the communications perhaps of the... Remember, you also have ways between the fields. So you can have a communications being developed into the cities and based in the cities. And people can go ahead and have a certain amount of commerce within the cities. It goes into the cities of the Levites, which are then counted as unwalled villages. Verse 32, the cities of the Levites, the house of the cities of their possession, the Levites may redeem at any time because they don't have an inheritance in the land as such. I'm just looking at the time. You can see, if you put in your notes, 1 Kings 21, verse 1 to 3, Naboth's vineyard and Ahab. That was all to do with this particular law. Naboth did not want to go ahead and sell his land, because it was his, and Ahab was wanting to have that land permanently. That was going to be part of his building. He says, no, I can't do that. This is my inheritance. And so he didn't want to go ahead and sell it. And he had full right to do that. And he had to get bumped off by Jezebel before Ahab could go in there and just seize it illegally. But it's all to do with this. Now, that presumably, whether that would probably actually be within the city. And he wouldn't want to sell it because it was part of his inheritance. He would have to redeem it within a year. And, you know, you wouldn't be able to do that. So that is all tied into that. I want you to notice over in Ezekiel 46, within this area of the Jubilee, Ezekiel 46. I've probably bitten off too much, quite frankly, trying to do three of these things in once. I should have probably limited it to sabbatical year alone. But Ezekiel 46... in Ezekiel 45 verse 1 it says, when you shall divide by lot the land for inheritance, then you'll offer oblation. So the land has been divided by lot, and it's talking about the world tomorrow. But here in Ezekiel 46, I want you to notice in verse 16 what actually is mentioned here. It says, thus says the Lord Eternal, if the prince give a gift to any of his sons, the inheritance thereof shall be his sons. It will be their possession by inheritance. So in other words, here is the prince with a certain amount of land within his family that he has control over. And he gives it to his son. Then his son can have that area of land as his inheritance, and he can give it to his son in perpetuity. But if he gives a gift of his inheritance to one of his servants, in other words, supposing somebody is working for him, or... I mean, Chatsworth, I don't know how Chatsworth actually came into the family, the Duke of Devonshire, but I mean, basically, presumably somebody gave it to them. It's some king that he'd done something and he gave it to them, and it was theirs forever and a day. Here is somebody who has done something for this prince, and he's going to give a gift of land. if he gives a gift to one of his servants, then it shall be his to the year of liberty, to the year of release. And the indication is this is talking in the millennium. The prince is very, it could well be, this prince is talking about you and I. Because it talks about us and it talks about our children. So if we might be able to give to our children, but if we start to give to somebody else, the indication is here, the inheritance shall be his sons for them. Moreover, the prince shall not take of the people's inheritance by oppression. Written into the law, written into the very word of God, it is impossible for the prince even to go ahead and take the land. You cannot do it. It is stopped. You know, there will be ways between the areas of land that will be put in there, because woe unto him that lays field to field and house to house. So there will be ways between. But that land, you can't go, you and I, as kings and priests in the future, having apportioned the land out and done it properly, by lot, we can't then say, oh, change my mind, I think we'll have a compulsory purchase over here. It doesn't work that way. God's law doesn't allow for that. It isn't there. And it says here, you must give it to thrust them out of their possession, but he shall give of his son's inheritance out of his own possession, that my people are not scattered, every man from his possession. The families and the land are then tied together. And so what this really means, what the Jubilee means to the world tomorrow, is there's no land speculation. Land speculators do not exist. Within the cities, yes, you can have buildings made within the cities. The cities can be grow up, and commercially they can be commercial centres. The ways between the plots of land will allow for communication. But the land itself, this land of unwalled villages, you can't have land speculation. The other thing is, it's in the hand of the families. I see nothing there that gives any indication of planning laws the way that we have them today. Now, it doesn't mean to say that we don't... There are laws in here that we can go back to. You know, you've got to put a balcony around your roof space, so a barrier around your roof, so you don't go ahead and fall off. There are planning laws like that. Building regulations. Building regulations will apply, that you love your neighbour as yourself. But not the way that we see today. Now, yes, there's a communication. You've got to live within a community. You love your neighbour as yourself, and that can be applied in a general way. But you don't have this barrage of laws that we have today. Inheritance tax doesn't exist. You don't find it. In fact, if anything, it's the exact opposite. It, in fact, encourages inheritance to the children and the children's children to the nth generation. It's the opposite the way we have today. There, as I say, there's no Chatsworth, unfortunately, for some, for people that live in Chatsworth. But there's no Chatsworth, not like that. You won't have thousands of acres that are in the hand of one family, and it just isn't going to work that way. Another thing as well, if you look at the subject of the Jubilee, is that it's dealing with real people. There is no such thing as a limited company that is treated as a person, or a public limited company, treated as a person in law, that will never die. It just doesn't work that way. They are real people, and the laws of God determine the relationship between real people, not this arbitrary concoction of man to hold on to wealth arbitrarily. We hold on to wealth by accountants, quite frankly. Okay, coming into usury, very, very quickly. Isaiah 2. There's something that's going to happen. Within the world, in the world tomorrow, that God is going to do. It says in Isaiah 2, verse 2, it says, "And it will come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Eternal's house shall be established on the top of the mountains, exalted above the hills, and all nations will flow to it. And many people shall go and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways. He will walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem. And he will judge among the nations and rebuke many nations, and they will turn their spears into pruning hooks." Now, we're looking here at a time when people will look at what's going on and say, look, let's go up and let's learn. How do they do this? What are they doing? We want to be part of it. And you think, well, what is it that's going to be causing that? They're going to see the result, the end result of the application of God's law. But you know, there's another thing that will have a distinct leverage effect on the situation, and that is the law of usury. Now, you can put in your notes, just read around Isaiah 59, verse 20, Isaiah 60, beginning of Isaiah 60, the beginning of Isaiah 62, this same concept of the Gentiles coming to your light. As I say, Isaiah 59:20, Isaiah 60, verse 1 to 3, Isaiah 62, verse 1 to 3, it gives the indication that the Gentiles will come, the nations will come to the light, they will try and understand what is actually going on. If you turn over to Leviticus chapter 19, Leviticus 19, we'll see one of these laws of God. Again, another one that hasn't, as far as I know, been really implemented. And I want you to notice that Leviticus 19, verse 33, it says, if a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not vex him. Notice. So it's talking about strangers. It's not talking about all the ethnically Israelites. It's talking about people that are part of Israel, but they're not actual Israelites. But the stranger that dwells with you, that's under the government of God, in other words, shall be unto you as one born among you, and you will love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Eternal your God. And you will do no unrighteousness in judgment, meter yard, weight, measure, a just balance, just weights, just ephah, just hin, you will have, and the I am the Eternal your God that brought you out of the land of Egypt, which we also are coming out of, the world that we're in. Therefore you will observe all my statutes, all my judgments, and do them. I am the Eternal. If we turn over the page a little bit, over to Leviticus 27, Leviticus 27, we see one of these laws regarding, as it says, a just balance, a just weights, a just hin, and so on. Here in Leviticus 27, verse 16, it says, and if a man will sanctify to the Eternal some part of a field of his possession, then your estimation shall be according to the seed thereof. An omer of barley seed. Now notice, what is he sanctifying? He's sanctifying the field. Its land is being talked about. But you do it according to what seed that land will produce. So you say, okay, that land will therefore grow this amount of seed. Therefore the land is worth according to the amount of seed. Notice what it says. An omer of barley seed will be valued at 50 shekels of silver. So the land that will produce an omer, that land is 50 shekels for 50 years between the jubilees. So you now have a relationship between the shekel, which is the unit of monetary exchange, and the land itself, and the productive capacity of the land. If you improve that land so you can double the yield, you've doubled the value. You can actually do that. You can improve the very value. Everybody's going to try and put as much mulch and everything else on to make sure that land produces as much as it can, because it's improving the value of its actual stock all the time. And if you sanctify the field from the year of the Jubilee, according to the estimation it will stand. But if you sanctify his field after the Jubilee, then the priest shall reckon to him the money according to the years that remain, even to the year of the Jubilee, and it will be abated from your estimation. So you see, it's the 50 shekels for 50 years. And if it goes back any, then if you've only got 25 years to the Jubilee, it's 25 shekels. So it's a shekel per omer produced, for each area of land that will produce an omer of barley. There's your relation. So all of a sudden, inflation is non-existent. There is your unit of measure. That gold standard. Gold will fluctuate according to this. It is tied to the very productive capacity of the land. It's written in black and white within the scripture, and it gives the currency stability that is there. Now, if we go back to Leviticus 25. Here is this society. It has a stable currency. It has a land that is productive. It has it doesn't have banks and borrowing. It is able to go ahead and get around this horrendous problem that we have in society today of debt. And here in Leviticus chapter 25, and in verse 35, it says, "And if your brother becomes poor and fall in decay with you, then you will relieve him." Yes, even if he's a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. It's not just a brother. It extends out unto people that are placing themselves under the laws of God. So you're immediately looking at other nations. If they become part of Israel, the commonwealth of Israel, they come under this umbrella. You see now why people will look at Israel and say, "Hey, we want a piece of that action." Because here, people are going to be helping one another. It's a way of give within the very society. It says, "Do not take any usury of him or increase, but you fear your God that your brother may live with you." So interest is banned. There is no interest. And remember, the sabbatical year means that at the end of 7 years, the capital is wiped out as well. Do you want a piece of that action? And of course people will want a piece of that action. They'll want that particular thing for themselves. "You will not give him your money upon usury, nor lend him victuals for increase. I am the Eternal your God that brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God." So this concept, again, you're looking at this Christ being the same yesterday, today and forever, where you're given, it'll be given to you. Pressed down, running over. If somebody wants to borrow, you do not turn away. This is coming right out of this law, given by the same God, by the same being, and it is that law that is going to be implemented in the world tomorrow that will produce the very society that we're looking at. And here you're seeing the actual area of usury being referred to. Put in your notes Isaiah 19 verse 22 to 25. Isaiah 19 verse 22 to 25. It talks about Israel with Assyria and with Egypt. Three nations, all part of this commonwealth that begins. But here, notice in Deuteronomy 23, turn over to Deuteronomy 23. You see this two-tier system in Deuteronomy 23, verse 19. The idea that you will never lend upon usury does not come out of Scripture. It doesn't come out of Scripture. You don't lend upon usury to somebody that is under the government of God. That comes out of Scripture. But when you notice here in Deuteronomy 23, it says, "You shall not lend upon usury," in verse 19. Deuteronomy 23, 19. "You will not lend upon usury to your brother." And it also, we just read, those that are also under the government of God, the strangers with them. Usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. And that means any interest. Interest just does not apply. To a stranger, that's somebody not under the government of God, you may lend upon usury or interest, but to your brother you will not lend upon usury, that the Eternal your God may bless you in all that you set your hand to within the land where you go in to possess it. So you suddenly see somebody under the government of God has interest free. Somebody without the government of God has it with interest. Now you see where these areas outside the Commonwealth of Israel will say, "Let us go up to the Eternal and let's see his ways." I mean, look at the prosperity these people have. Look at what you can do. I mean, these guys don't even charge each other interest. At the end of 7 years, they forgive the capital. I mean, it is an incredible, incredible law. Absolutely incredible law. And if we look around the natural world, and we do, we see 100 elements producing this myriad of reality that we're in today. 100 simple compounds. Not even a compound, they're an element. There's something standing by itself that then have to combine to make a compound. And each of those elements, the reason why they behave in the certain way they do is because they've got a proton and a neutron in the centre, and you've got electrons around about and you've got a number of the number of electrons on the outside, so it changes the various element, and it therefore combines in different ways. You have a different structure there. But it's an incredibly simple, a simple concept, but profound results, giving everything, including our bodies and everything, all based on these very, very simple laws. You look into the law of God, and you can see exactly the same thing for the world tomorrow. Three simple laws, you know, in addition to the Ten Commandments. You're looking at the sabbatical year, the Jubilee, and also this law about usury. Simple laws that produce simply profound results, and God speed that day.